Welcome to On the Way with Tony Crisp. Each weekday, Dr. Crisp will be discussing biblical passages, people, places, and prophecies. Tune in daily to start your day right and deepen your understanding of how to better walk the way and enjoy the journey. Here's your host, Dr. Tony Crisp.
Welcome to On the Way. This is Tony Crisp, and this is Podcast 1086. Today, we're going to look at 1st and 2nd Thessalonians, and I want to give you an overview of that and kind of give you an idea of how these letters developed. When Paul was in ancient Troy, the city of Troas in the book of Acts, you'll recall that he saw a vision to come over to Europe and help those that were there hungering for the gospel. God had prepared hearts, and he wanted to get the Apostle Paul there. Paul had wanted to go north and east into Bithynia. He tried once, and he tried again, and God said no. Now, just like the Apostle Paul, let's just stop there a moment. There are times when we strongly feel that we need to do something. That doesn't mean it's God. It just means that we need to test that before the Lord, and we need to act on the light we have. And if we feel like indeed God wants us to do something, we try to do that, God stops us. Well, that's a warning. Be careful. But then the second time that you try and the door closes, you might want to look at another option that God might be giving you. So keep being faithful, keep trusting the Lord, stay right where you are until God gives you more light. But in the case of the Apostle Paul, after he had tried more than one time to go into Bithynia and go a certain way, God said no. As Paul sought God's face and continued to be obedient right where he was in the ancient city of Troas, then God gave him a vision in the night saying, come over into Europe and help us. Now, that was another continent. This is a place where the gospel had not been preached by the Apostle Paul. And in Troas, it was not a wasted time because they gathered the resources there. Paul met his personal physician that would be with him the rest of his life, the writer of the Gospel of Luke, the writer of the book of Acts. And it was a godsend. His time in Troas, even though it was not long. And as you'll recall, in Acts chapter 16, the scripture says that he went over into Europe. He landed at Neapolis, made his way inland to the city, the Roman colony of Philippi. It is historically rich. That is where Brutus and Cassius, the assassins of Julius Caesar, were defeated by Octavian, later to become Augustus, and Mark Antony. That was all done near the plains of Philippi. But it was a Roman colony, and we have already looked at that. It's one of the prison epistles. They were called Macedonians. That was Upper Greece, so what is Northern Greece today, that was Macedonia. And they are referred to in Paul's letters to the Corinthians as the Macedonians. They were poor. They did not have a lot, but their generosity was overwhelming. And they supported the Apostle Paul's ministry, and you can read about that in the book of 1 Corinthians and 2 Corinthians as Paul talks to the Corinthians about the example of giving and generosity of the people at Philippi. But they left there, and in chapter 17 of Acts, I'm giving you the background now of the work at Thessaloniki. Now, when they had passed through Amphipolis, these are just right along the coast, cities along the coast, Apollonia, they came to Thessaloniki. Now, if you've never been to Thessaloniki, I want to assure you it is a beautiful, spectacular city. It's a port city. There's a beautiful harbor there, and you can see the mountains all around. You can see Mount Olympus from there. The hills go right down to the sea, and it was a great, great seaport, an ancient seaport. This is where Paul came, and as his custom was, he went into the synagogue of the Jews, and he began to reason with them, and he only did this for 3 Shabbats, 3 weeks. It says he reasoned from them from the scriptures, and verse 3 says, it's fascinating, these are words that are not usually used for what Paul did. because the word that is used for explaining is the word which means to open up. It's actually three words. It's the word dia, a preposition dia, and then another word, which is a preposition, ana, A-N-A. So you have D-I-A, A-N-A, and then oigo. Oigo means to open, O-I-G-O, long O, as in omega. And it means to open. So it means to thoroughly open again. So it's translated explain or explaining. He did this over and over and over again. And not only that, but it says he was demonstrating. That means, if I could translate this word, it's the combination word para, P-A-R-A, you know, para, we call it, something alongside. And tithemi, that word which means to stand, it means to stand close to someone. And used in this context, I would translate this, if I were just talking, just you and me, and I would say, Paul got up close and personal to them. He became very close to them. He opened up the scriptures, and he explained them, and he got very personal with them. It was personal discipleship. And what he was doing is he was demonstrating, that is, up close and personal, that Jesus was the Christ, the anointed one. He was the Messiah. He was not just coming to rule, as the Jews thought during that day that that's what the Messiah would do. He would come and he would throw off the yoke of whatever government it was in the time that he came. In this instance, would have been Rome. And he would free the people and set up his earthly rule, because that's what the prophets had prophesied. But they didn't understand that the mystery of the kingdom was not just that he was going to rule. Oh, he's going to one day. But now he is spiritually ruling and reigning within the heart of every believer. So he is the Lord of a personal life. And he is Lord of the universe, yes. And he is Lord of this earth, yes. And one day he will rule and reign for 1,000 years. Now, that doesn't mean just because there is spiritual rule in the heart of the believer now that there's not going to be a literal, physical, political kingdom, and there's going to be. And it's going to be a theocracy. God's going to rule. There's not going to be any voting on anything. God is going to rule. I believe sometimes in the West we're drunk with democracy and we think that this is God's way of doing things. Well, this is one of the ways that God set up for man to govern himself. But the reality is that democracy and free enterprise and capitalism, as wonderful as it is, it's only wonderful as it is based and rooted in a Judeo-Christian biblical values worldview. Because apart from that, it's nothing more than greed and avarice and dog eat dog. And we see that in our nation today as it crumbles from within, not from without, but from within, because the law of restraint is cast off. There is no moral base within the fiber of America anymore. The family has broken down. There's not a passing on of the faith from one generation to the next. And we have no moral foundation. And so the nation is crumbling from within. And this is what Paul was doing. He was explaining to them all of these various aspects of Messiah's rule and reign. And he said, this Jesus whom I preach to you, and again, this is not the word caruso. It's not the normal word to proclaim. It is the word kata, which means down, and then angelo, which means to speak or to point out something. That's what kata and angelo together means, to point down, get down to the nitty-gritty and point out something specifically. And so that's what he did. He didn't have long with him, so he needed to get right to the point, and that's what he did. And it says, and some of them were persuaded. They came over to his side, and a great multitude of the devout Greeks, not a few of the leading women, joined Paul and Silas. So some of the Jews were persuaded. Greeks, who are Gentiles, some of the Jews believed from the synagogue, a great multitude of devout Greeks believed, and not a few of the leading women joined Paul and Silas. In other words, they had great success there. But it wasn't long, just 3 weeks after arriving there, even with all the success, the Jews became envious and they began to stir up trouble. They couldn't find Paul, so they brought Jason, who was his host there, and brought him before the Bema, before the judge, and did everything they could to lie and insinuate that they were trying to overthrow Rome. That's silliness, but that's what they were saying. And so the brethren immediately sent Paul and Silas away to Berea. You know the story from there, and from there they went to Athens. Paul went alone, which was not good for him to be alone. And he got anxious and went out and went to Mars Hill and started debating with people. And that really was not that fruitful because he had no solid converts there, not even enough to baptize anyone. And then he went on to Corinth. But I want you to understand how important it was, because when Paul got to Corinth, he was very concerned about the believers at Thessaloniki. And so he was afraid that he had been there such a short time. And even though he was so close to them and got very close to them quickly. And if you've been out around the country or been in other nations, you know, you can go spend a week with someone, 2 weeks, 3 weeks with someone. And the next thing you know, they're closer than your brother. They're closer than your sister. They're closer than family. They're closer to many Christians that you have been around, followers of Jesus, wherever you are in the States or in Europe or in South or Central America. You get very close to somebody that you haven't known but a very short time, and it's a spiritual connection. That's the only way I can say it. There is true koinonia. There is a sharing of a fellowship bond that's beyond anything the world will ever know anything about. And so Paul wrote from Corinth to see how they were doing, and he shared with them great truths. Many believe this is the first letter that the Apostle Paul wrote. Others believe that it's the book of Galatians, but there's not much difference, six and one, half a dozen the other, because they were all written in that same time period. I believe that sometime around 51, 52, that you have 1st and 2nd Thessalonians written, and Paul wrote back to them. He was doctrinally heavy, especially in eschatology. He was teaching them because that was a great motivation for evangelism. But in chapter 2, you have something that is unique to this group. So Paul said that he cherished them and loved them in an incredible way. Verse 7 of chapter 2 says, "But we were gentle among you, just as a nursing mother cherishes her own children, so affectionately longing for you. We were well pleased to impart to you not only the gospel, the good news of God, but also our own lives, because you became dear to us." You became beloved. And it's interesting, Paul doesn't say that about everybody, but God gave him a special bond with the church at Thessaloniki, and he shared with them some of the greatest passages having to do with eschatology are in 1st and 2nd Thessalonians. He was encouraged by the effect of the letter in his ministry there, but he had to turn around very quickly after hearing from them that indeed they were doing well. There was doctrinal heresy that was developing because some false teachers had come in and said, "Look, Paul is deceiving you, and the day of the Lord has already come. We're already, this persecution that we're going through," and there was heavy persecution in Thessaloniki. He said, "He's not told you the whole truth because you're in the middle of the day of the Lord now." And so Paul wrote 2 Thessalonians to say this day of the Lord will not come unless, and he laid out in chapter 2, the great apostasy and the man of sin that would be raised up. The temple of God would be the center of the deceit. And he goes into all of this in 2 Thessalonians chapter 2. And he encouraged them to stand fast in what he had taught them, and don't be deceived, don't worry, don't fret. And we don't know what all was going on there, but the Apostle Paul felt like it was urgent that he write back very quickly and counteract heresy. And I want to just say to you from a pastoral note, for those of you who are pastors and teachers and leaders and elders, and those of you who serve as deacons in the church, you've got to deal with heresy very quickly and very decisively. You cannot mess around with it because it's like a rattlesnake. You wouldn't put a rattlesnake in with little babies, or you're in the house. You would take it out, cut its head off. You would kill it. You would get it away from harming anyone that you know and love. And I would say to you, this is the way of heresy. Heresy is like a snake. It comes in, it sneaks in, the next thing you know, it's biting you. And so when there are heresies, that is deviations from truth in the scriptures, and heretics, those that are espousing these heretical doctrines and teachings and being divisive, that's what a heretic is, one who divides, anyone who deviates. The Apostle Paul gives very strict instructions later, and we'll look at that in another context, where he says a person who is a heretic that's divisive after the first and second admonition, then you've got to deal with it. In other words, warn them, say, hey, we don't do this here. This is not the way that's to be carried out. Then if they do it again, you warn them and say, this is the last time because I've told you don't do it. Now you've done it. I'm warning you. You do it again and there's going to be severe consequences. Now, that doesn't mean you're going to beat them up. You're going to shoot them. You're going to cut them, anything like that. What it means is you're going to take bold action in the name of Jesus and you will deal with the heresy. If they're going to be public about it, you are going to be public about it and you deal with it decisively. And you do this so that others will know that there's not going to be room for heresy within the Church of Jesus. Now, that means you need to know what you believe and you need to understand that what you do, you need to do firmly, but not hatefully, not in spite. You've got to check your own motives. One of the reasons we need to be careful about any kind of discipline within the Church of Jesus is to make sure it's all done in a spirit of love and redemption. It's not punitive. It's not to punish. Church discipline is always redemptive in nature. And even when you have to commit someone to the devil, as Paul talked about in 1 Corinthians chapter 5, he said, when you do this so that, yes, the body may be destroyed, but the soul will be saved, because that's the whole idea is redemption. And so 1 and 2 Thessalonians, it won't take you long to read through them. They're very eschatological. That is, they deal with the doctrine of last things, the teaching of last things. And I want to encourage you to get in the book, read the book, love the book, and ask God to show you Jesus. For On the Way, this is Tony Crisp.
Thanks for listening to On the Way with Tony Crisp. Tune in every weekday for information on biblical passages, people, places, and prophecies. Fridays are for your questions. Email your questions to questions@tonycrisp.org, then just listen for your question to be answered on Friday's podcast. That's questions@tonycrisp.org. Thanks for listening, and have a blessed day on the way.